You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
First Nations listeners are advised that the following program may contain the names and voices of our mob who have passed on to the dreaming. Yeah, so today I wanted to talk about something a bit different. There's a few things I want to talk about, but they're all very interrelated, and it's the United States and the current affairs over there, as well as a bit of the history. In particular, you know, I want to start off talking a bit about the history of the United States post the Civil War that happened over there. Well, at least, you know, post the one of the first Civil Wars. There has actually been a few Civil Wars that have happened in the United States. But, you know, there's only really one main one that we are taught about, which was the one that ended in 1865. So, you know, what happened after 1865 was, after the formal end of the Civil War, political conflict over there, it very much continued just in another form. Pardon me. After the Civil War ended, there was a period known as the Reconstruction. The Reconstruction triggered sustained organized violence that was aimed at actually reversing the abolition of slavery, and, you know, was aimed at black citizenship and multiracial governance. This period functioned as a internal war over the political future of that country, that colony. If you don't know what Reconstruction was, Reconstruction created real multiracial democracy in many senses. During Reconstruction, you had a lot of the formerly enslaved people now able to vote, able to hold office, able to shape law, and, you know, being involved in government at local and state levels. Now, these governments expanded the public education, they expanded labor protections and civil rights in ways that had not been seen before and have not been seen since in the United States colony. Now, what happened as a result of this was you had white supremacist organizations operating as armed political forces to try and reverse this Reconstruction period. You had groups like the Ku Klux Klan, the White League, and what were they called? The Red Shirts, who functioned as these paramilitary organizations. Their main purpose was to suppress black political participation and to restore white elite control through targeted violence and intimidation. Now, you know, you've got to kind of really set the scene for this period. You had quite a lot of black people, you know, formerly enslaved black people, African Americans, who were now being elected into government and into different positions within the institutions over there. And especially down in the southern states where racism had been a lot more entrenched and a lot more powerful than in the northern states, down in those, what were they called? I'm having a complete mental blank. The fellows with the red flag with the white stripe, white X and the stars for it. You know what I'm talking about. I've forgotten what they're called. Had a horrible sleep last night. but anyways, you had these people, these racists who were from these southern states, and they were suddenly finding themselves quite outnumbered after the abolition of slavery. You know, you got to remember at the time there was quite a lot of African American people who had been enslaved in those southern states, out on those plantations and in those other industries where slaves were prominent, and they very much outnumbered quite a lot of the white population there, especially in terms of voting. So suddenly you had all of these black people who were able to vote, and they were voting in other black people. And of course, the racists didn't like this. So what actually happened was the Ku Klux Klan and these other groups I mentioned just before, the Red Shirts and the White League and, you know, various other similar groups, they actually began to attack polling places, they began to assassinate elected officials, and they overturned election outcomes. It's also worth noting here that, again, you know, it's a whole conversation in itself, but at the time, these African American people, they were running as Republicans. You know, when all this happened at the end of the Civil War in 1865, you actually had the Democrats, who were the far-right party, and the Republicans were a lot more left. You know, there has since been a shift. Those parties have somewhat swapped their positions on the political spectrum. You know, don't get me wrong, the Democrats are still a right-wing party today, but, you know, there's a case to be made that they're arguably somewhat more left than the overt racists in the Republican Party. But yeah, you had these paramilitary groups going out and doing all these assassinations and attacking polling booths and attacking, elected black officials. And there was even cases where the KKK and these other paramilitary racist groups actually went to war with the newly formed United States government. One such example is the Battle of Liberty Place, which involved the sitting governor of, I believe it was Louisiana, who called in the National Guard and the state military to try and, you know, protect these black elected officials and protect this new government system. And they were actually defeated by Ku Klux Klan militias. You know, there was a second civil war that happened there where white supremacists went to war with the United States government again, but this time they actually won. And people don't know much about this history. It's definitely not something that is taught, but it's something that very much happened. You know, that's the Battle of Liberty Place. It's just one example. There's actually several examples right across the southern half of the United States that you can go and Google and read up about if you want more information. But yeah, when they defeated the National Guard, they seized control of the government buildings there. And what happened as a result was the federal troops who were deployed to restore order, they somewhat, you know, for lack of a better term, they did restore order after this second civil war, but they done it in a way that very much capitulated to the Ku Klux Klan and these other racist white wing groups. It resulted in the end of the Reconstruction period and the assertion of white supremacy and these white supremacists and racists retaking power again. You know, all these former slave owners and plantation owners. Now, you might be familiar with Jim Crow. You might have heard reference in your life to the Jim Crow era and Jim Crow governance, when they re-brought in segregation laws and voter suppression and more racial terror, and as well as the convict leasing system, which followed directly after the defeat of the Reconstruction governments. Now, these systems very much ensured that political exclusion and economic exploitation could continue, quote-unquote, legally. Now, the conflict, you know, as I mentioned, it's never been formally addressed or dismantled. There was no comprehensive process to investigate the political violence. There was no proper dismantling of these paramilitary powers like the Ku Klux Klan. And there was no restoration of rights for black African Americans. Instead, what we had was white supremacist rule being stabilized without any sort of accountability and a revert to the situation pre the original 1865 Civil War that you might be familiar with. Now, I'm talking about this because, you know, it's very much reflects today in contemporary US politics. You've got modern voter suppression, you've got modern armed intimidation, you've got all these challenges to election legitimacy, which follow these established patterns from the Reconstruction period. Political violence over there is something that is still very much remains tied to efforts to restrict democratic participation, as well as the way that they've set up, you know, all their electoral colleges or whatever they're called over there. Now, there has since been, you know, other recent coup attempts. One was the January 6th incident, which happened back in, I believe it was 2021, where you had a bunch of right-wing people storming the Capitol building in Washington there, trying to illegally reinstate Trump. You know, it's something that follows this same pattern of the Ku Klux Klan taking on the government and actually winning. Now, Trump himself represents a return to counter Reconstruction politics. You know, Trump is someone who rose to power by openly rejecting multiracial democracy as some sort of political norm. You know, his campaigns normalized voter suppression, they racialized fear, and the idea that elections are only legitimate when his side is the one that wins. This, as I mentioned, you know, very much mirrors the past post-Reconstruction logic that political authority belongs to a specific racial and social order and not to the electorate as a whole. Now, part of the reason I'm talking about this is, you know, the state of affairs there today. You've got ICE, for example, which functions as an internal enforcement arm of racial order. You've got the, you know, US Immigration and Customs Enforcement operating with these expansive powers with limited accountability and using routine use of terror as deterrence. The role of ICE very much resembles historical paramilitary enforcement. It's targeting racialized populations, operating with political cover, and enforcing exclusion through fear. And also, when you look at where ICE has actually been deployed to across the United States, its majority of the ICE incidences are happening in these so-called blue states where the Democrats hold a majority. So, you know, it's very much being used as a political endeavor to suppress any opposition to the Republican Party. Now, you've also got this fusion of state power and extra-legal violence, which, you know, as I mentioned, has this precedent here. You've got the Reconstruction-era militias and the modern enforcement bodies sharing that same structural function where they're maintaining social hierarchy when formal democratic mechanisms produce unwanted outcomes for the white supremacist government over there. You know, the difference, of course, is presentation, not the actual purpose. Violence over there is currently being bureaucratized rather than openly insurgent, as it was as a result of the Ku Klux Klan back in that post and during that Reconstruction era. Now, you've still got stuff like the elite impunity remaining a stabilizing feature of US power. You know, you've got the continued public relevance of people like Jeffrey Epstein, highlighting how power itself very much insulates itself. You know, Epstein's network has revealed systematic protection of elite figures right across politics, finance, and the media over there. His prosecution did not actually dismantle any of these networks. Instead, you know, it very much reinforced a long tradition of accountability stopping short of the ruling interests. You've also got stuff like a bit of a trigger warning too, from I'm about to talk about. I'm going to talk about some sensitive and very disgusting things. You've got, you know, stuff like sexual violence and racial control and political power all being linked in together over there. You know, from that Reconstruction period onward, you've had racial terror, you've had sexual violence, and you've had elite protection operating together. The same systems that have suppressed democratic participation also protect the perpetrators over there. And, you know, all these perpetrators, they belong to the ruling class. And it's not, you know, anything new is the point I'm trying to make here. It's a continuation of those pre-Jim Crow era times when the Ku Klux Klan had their little coup and were successful in it. Something else I want to touch on as well is the present instability reflects an unresolved political settlement. You know, the United States never actually resolved the conflict over who democracy is for. You know, Trump, ICE, and these elites, they're the contemporary expressions of that unresolved struggle. They're not a, departure from it or a aberration or, you know, any sort of new thing. It's very much a continuation of the government system that the United States has operated under. Now, I'm not going to go too much into the Epstein file stuff, but one thing I do want to really touch on here is just how disgusting it is, but also how powerless so much of the working class over there actually are. And they're not powerless because they lack the ability to rise up against their government. They're powerless because they've been captured by a lot of these liberal sentiments and, you know, they've been desensitized and they've been made to accept this norm. You know, it's come out in these files that there's been all sorts of absolutely horrendous violent acts happening. You know, quite a lot of the conspiracies that we've heard over the last decade or more about, you know, pedophile rings and Satan worship and, you know, all of this other stuff, even as far as, you know, cannibalism, you know, a lot of this stuff has actually come out in the Epstein files. You know, it's not something that is a conspiracy anymore. And you would think that learning that your president is a pedophile and, you know, has engaged in all these absolutely horrendous, disgusting acts, you would think it would compel the American people to actually rise up and do something. You know, maybe that's part of the reason why ICE is so prominent at the moment and has all these expanded powers to prevent exactly that from happening. But still, you know, ICE is a small minority in terms of the broader working class population of the United States. You know, so why aren't they actually doing anything about it? Why aren't they rising up? Well, you know, to answer that question, we need only to look here in our own backyard. I've had a bit of a troll through these files, and you know what else I found that was quite unsurprising, but alarming nevertheless, is that every single Prime Minister of Australia since Keating is also listed multiple times in these Epstein files. So are a lot of our past Attorney Generals and, you know, High Court judges and, you know, these other arms of the government and the judiciary, you know, the ruling elite here in this colony. Quite a lot of them are implicated in these Epstein files as well. You know, why aren't people compelled to do anything here about that either? It's almost as if people are so beaten down and so desensitized and so liberalized that they are, you know, on the one hand willing to condemn these acts, but at the same time willing to accept them and willing to accept the political norm that it has created. Something for people to really sit with and think about. You know, it's essentially, you know, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but as I said, quite a lot of these conspiracies have, you know, it's come to light that there's actually quite a lot of evidence to support them. But yeah, you know, why is it that we are all so happy and content to be ruled by some of the most despicable people imaginable? Also, something else I just want to kind of touch on here is, you know, quite often, and I talk about this a lot when I talk about Western chauvinism. Do you know who wasn't named in those files? Quite a lot of the people that even the so-called left would condemn as enemies and tyrants and whatever else, you know. I'm talking about people like Xi Jinping, you know, the ruler of China. I'm talking about people like Kim Jong-un from North Korea. You know, I'm talking about these people like Assad, for example. You know, people like Vladimir Putin. They're not listed in the Epstein files. You know, in fact, they've themselves have spoken out for decades now about how atrocious the rulers of these Western nations are and how despicable and disgusting their acts are. So yeah, it's just something to think about next time you decide you want to point the finger and condemn tyrants abroad. You know, we are ruled by tyrants here in the West, right across the entire Western Empire. We're ruled by the most despicable, heinous, disgusting tyrants imaginable. You know, another thing I'll just mention quickly about these files that have come out. When you look at Australia in the files, there's two particular places of note that are quite recurring in them. First off, though, I want to, you know, talk about the fact that the Australian media has failed to, you know, meaningfully report on this in any way. You know, as with the Borloo bombing incident, you know, it's something that has been met with silence and, you know, swept under the rug and ignored and dismissed. But yeah, there's two places in particular that quite often show up in these files. Two places in South Australia, actually. Port Pirie and Kadena. Now, these are two small towns in South Australia. I think together they've got a combined population of only about 20,000 people. But there is quite a lot of mentions to them in there. You know, quite a lot of these mentions, again, tie back in with prime ministers going as far back as Keating. Now, there's several hundred pages, you know, don't get me wrong, it's and quite a lot of the stuff in there as well, you know, is factual evidence, but also quite a lot of it is accounts that might not be factual, you know, people's own self-reporting and, you know, other similar stuff. But yeah, there's quite a lot of mentions to these two towns. Now, these two towns do have, you know, significant Indigenous populations as well as impoverished populations. And yeah, it's something worth really investigating, in my opinion. You know, of course, the mainstream media is not going to do this. But, you know, something that, you know, people should really start to look into, start to, if you can stomach it, of course, you know, start to actually investigate into, because, you know, this may or may not be the case that there was actually people trafficked from these two places over to Epstein's Island and, you know, to elsewhere in the world. Something very, very disgusting, but also very, very alarming. But also, as I said before, you know, unsurprising as well. You know, Aboriginal people, Aboriginal children in particular, have been exported from this continent to other places in the West for so long now, since the 1800s. You know, you look at the stolen generations, quite a lot of those children were, you know, given out to white families here on this continent, but quite a lot of them were actually sent overseas as well, you know, adopted out into the Americas and into Europe to live with white families there and to essentially be enslaved as well, to, you know, work as housemaids and house servants and work on plantations and whatever else. Again, you know, without pay, you know, any form of pay would be rations. Another form of slavery, well, it is, it's not even another form, it's straight up slavery at the end of the day. That's how slavery operated. But yeah, it's something that people should, you know, again, if you can stomach it, should investigate, you know, look a bit into that, and question why, you know, why you are happy, and even if you're not happy, why you're complacent to live under this rule of these disgusting, heinous people who have committed all sorts of vile, disgusting acts. You know, again, every Prime Minister in Australia is, since Keating, has, and including Keating, has been mentioned in his files multiple times. You know, something unsurprising, but also something that is very alarming. This is another song. I'm not going to talk about it too much more. It's a very disgusting thing, and it's, you know, I acknowledge that's a very triggering thing as well. The stuff that has been talked about in these files and that's come to light, you know, something that, you know, a lot of listeners might find triggering. So we'll end it there for now. I might do a bit more investigation on, talk about this a bit more in the coming weeks. I'll be sure to give a trigger warning before I do, if I do.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.